Welcome to Season 2 and another edition of The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, I'm Linda Chalker Scott, and welcome back to Season 2 of The Informed Gardener. After that introduction, you might be wondering, what exactly is it that I do as an Extension Urban Horticulturist? Well, I take information from articles about plant science and then I translate it so you can use it in your garden. And if you celebrate Thanksgiving, this week you'll be looking forward to a feast. And you'll be revisiting that feast as you deal with all those leftovers. So in keeping with the season, the theme this week is leftovers. And we're extending that theme into this week's interview as well. We'll be visiting with Terry Gillis, who is the General Manager of Recovery One, a rather unusual recycling plant in Tacoma, Washington. But first of all, let's look at some leftovers in the news. So our first item comes from the UK's Sunday Mercury, which is a really great online newspaper. And the title of this article was, Microwaves Turn Orange Peel into Gold. And when I first saw this, I thought, wow, they finally figured out alchemy that can change one substance into another one. It's not quite that exciting, but it's really interesting from a recycling perspective. So there was a researcher at University of York, which is in Great Britain, and he invented a microwave oven that takes food waste and turns them into other useful chemicals. His first effort at this cost a little bit over $300,000, and it takes orange peels and turns them into things like pectins, which if you make jams and jellies, that's the thickener for making jams and jellies, turns them into water purification materials, so kind of filtering materials, insulation, and ethanol. So this last part is probably why they nicknamed this project the Orange Peel Exploitation Company, or OPEC for short. So you might ask, why are they using orange peels? Well, it turns out that in Brazil, which is the largest producer of orange juice in the world, almost half the fruit is actually discarded after they squeeze the juice out. So they've got all this material and actually 8 million tons a year of orange leftovers. And this could be extended to lots of different things. It could be, you could reuse the husks and leaves left over from grain harvesting, nutshells, coffee grounds, overripe fruit, off lettuce, you name it. If it's food that you can't eat and it's vegetable in nature, you could recycle it this way. So the little prototype looks like a kitchen microwave and it breaks down the cellulose in the orange peels in this particular instance into a whole bunch of different chemicals that could be further refined. And they're even looking at an industrial version, which even though it costs $1.5 million, could actually process 6 tons of material an hour. I mean, it'd be an amazing process. And the researchers are hoping that in the future that we would have food waste pickup right from your home or from restaurants, and they'd take it along with other recycled materials to one of these processing plants. Or maybe you just drop it off yourself at a community center where they'd have one of these little processing plants set up. Personally, I think it'd be very cool to have a home-sized version. And this way, the kids wouldn't have to sneak their sweet potatoes under the table for the dog to eat. The second article is from Science Daily, which is another great online source of news information. And this one's called Nitrogen Fertilizer's Impact on Lawn Soils. And so everyone's familiar with agricultural fertilizers running off into lakes and rivers and causing all kinds of problems. You know, phosphate and nitrogen, when you have too much of them, they create dead zones where the oxygen levels are so low that hardly anything can live there. It turns out that lawns may also be a culprit. The leftover nitrogen that's part of the fertilizer that's put on ends up possibly in the water as well. And you may not think it's that much of a problem, but all the lawns in the United States actually cover an area almost as large as Florida. So there's really a lot of lawn out there. So scientists have conducted studies on this for a number of years, but the problem is they've been pretty inefficient in terms of figuring out how much is actually lost to water systems. So they do input-output studies that tells them how much material was put in, they measure how much is taken by plants, and they assume that whatever's left over has been runoff. It doesn't take into account the fact that some of that missing nitrogen might actually be lost as a gas. And this process is called denitrification, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it's still nitrogen, but it happens that it goes from a solid form, usually nitrate, into some kind of nitrogen gas form. So researchers at Cornell have found some recent technology that makes it a little bit easier to measure that nitrogen gas emission from home lawns. So rather than just assuming that everything is running off, they can actually figure out how much is coming off as a gas rather than running off into the water. And it turns out that most of the nitrogen that's put on as fertilizer onto lawns actually stays in the soil, which is good. Small amounts get transported to groundwater and streams, not as much as they assumed, but 15% of it actually is lost by denitrification. So in other words, 15% of the solid nitrogen actually turns into gas. And it's only under very specific conditions this happens. So it's mostly when the soil is very wet, soil oxygen is low, and there's lots of nitrogen available. And then some of that nitrate is converted into nitrogen gas. So any kind of lawn or grass system that's overwatered, over-fertilized, and perhaps compacted is going to be ideal for this denitrification process. And in practical terms, that means maybe a home lawn, golf courses, even cow pastures, all of which get lots of nitrogen and which can become very compacted and wet during winter conditions. So this is kind of a good news, bad news study. The good news is that much less nitrate is actually running off into aquatic systems, so lawns aren't nearly as bad as we thought they might be in terms of adding pollution to water systems. But the bad news is the gas that's coming off is actually nitrous oxide, which you might remember is used by dentists for doing major surgery, like having your wisdom teeth out, and it relaxes you and makes you laugh. But it also in nature is a greenhouse gas that is even worse than carbon dioxide in terms of really creating a heat effect on Earth. So that really makes me wonder, is Laughing Cow cheese produced with milk from cows inhaling nitrous oxide? So in keeping with our recycling theme this week, today we're going to meet Terry Gillis, who's the general manager of Recovering One, a recycling company that accepts non-typical recycling items like demolition debris and even carpet. So all that old stuff that you see that gets torn down from buildings, it doesn't go in the landfill anymore, it goes down to Terry's plant. And their company manufactures a bunch of different products, but the one I've been personally interested in has been a wood mulch product, and we've actually been observing it in field trials with newly planted trees and shrubs. But they're doing a lot more than just making mulch, as you'll hear. Well, today we're on site at Recovery One with General Manager Terry Gillis. And Terry, tell us exactly what it is that Recovery One does.
Well, we recycle buildings. We recycle new building materials when the buildings are being erected, and we recycle old buildings coming down from demolition processes.
So you're not the typical recycling place that takes cans and bottles and paper and things like that?
No, we're more into drywall and wood and carpet and things like that.
Well, the reason that I met Terry in the first place is we were doing some research together on a soil amendment material, but most recently you've manufactured a product that I'm very excited about, which is your recycled wood mulch. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the wood mulch, we start off with a clean wood product, and we shred it down to about a 1-inch minus or a 1-inch nominal, and then we colorize it in three different colors. The colors we're running right now are black, dark walnut, and red.
So the nice thing about this product, because as everyone knows who listens to me, I love arborist wood chips. The one thing about arborist wood chips is they're not very uniform in color, and you're making a product then that would appeal to people not just functionality but aesthetics too.
Yeah, it's a very pretty product. It holds the colorant real well, and so you can go year after year with a nice dark color, be it red, dark walnut, or black. There's a multitude of colors available. However, they get fair spendy depending on, you know, if you want to get into greens and yellows and oranges and blues, they're available, but they're very expensive.
So presumably, if you wanted to have a yard that's mulch matched your school colors, you could do that.
Oh, yeah, you could have the whole rainbow out there. We had one fellow who was considering doing a pirate ship for his kids, and he wanted the pirate ship sitting in blue mulch. And that was great right till he got the price.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, I wouldn't recommend such interesting colors for mulch, but I really like the material you make. And just as a side note, you and I are involved again in doing some research on this to measure the usefulness of this material in terms of weed control and in plant survival. And that research is actually just finishing up, and it'll get finished next spring. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yes, we're looking forward to those results. I think it'll really be a nice positive enhancement to the whole overall project.
So the mulch is the reason that I was particularly excited about what Recovery One did, but you've got some other things that you've been doing recently too that might be of interest to everybody, but gardeners in particular. In fact, we're looking at a couple buckets of things that people that do gardening or possibly do agriculture would be interested in knowing about.
The one bucket I was showing you here is our processed gypsum, and what makes our processed gypsum a pretty unique product is that it is finely processed. And we don't grind it down to this size. We crush it. And why that's important is it enables us to get the paper out. So it is almost pure gypsum. And then the other product that we're looking at is calcium carbonate from carpet backing. And this is a new venture we started. The company's called Carpet Processing and Recycling LLC. At this point in time, it is a experiment. We're not ready to come to market yet. However, we are able to extract the calcium carbonate off the backing of the carpet as one of the products that we believe will have some potential in the agricultural arena. And then, of course, we're extracting the face fibers, be it nylon 6, 6,6, polypropylene, PET, and then the backings, which are traditionally polypropylene at this time.
So now about the gypsum, which is also nicely ground up. Now, I know how you get it, but why don't you explain exactly where the gypsum comes from?
Well, wallboard is a gypsum product, sometimes referred to as drywall. The wallboard product typically comes in 4x8 by half-inch sheets. And what we're getting here is coming off of the job sites. Either it's a scrap from new construction, or it could be the drywall from a renovation or demolition project. And, of course, before we accept renovation or demolition projects, we have to make sure we're not getting contaminated material that could have asbestos and or lead paint on it. So we are very diligent in testing for that material. However, when we process it, we are crushing the material to separate the paper from the gypsum. And then the gypsum becomes a very fine powder, which we screen out, and then we load it up in 30-ton truckloads going out of the facility.
Well, it really is quite remarkable. So you could have a house that was being torn down and have the wallboard end up being gypsum for agriculture and the wood ending up being mulch for someone else's landscape.
That is a potential, yes. Very possible.
So I remember when I first met you several years ago, Terry, and you were telling me about Recovery One. Your goal was to take things that were being put into landfill and recycle them so that less would be going to landfill. And there was some percentage, and I don't remember what it was, but what percentage of things are you able to make second use of before you have to throw something away?
Well, we talk about two different diversion numbers. The first number is 98.5%. And that includes a product that we actually make for the landfill called alternate daily cover. And so that's one number. Another number is total landfill diversion, where it doesn't go into landfill in any way, shape, or form. And that number hovers around 80%.
Well, that's pretty amazing considering all this stuff is things that you can't put through normal recycling outlets that you would normally just have to throw away. And when I came up and I saw the huge piles of stuff that are out here, it's really quite amazing how much stuff gets diverted here.
Yeah, we're kind of unique in the industry in that regard, in that we do extract an awful lot of material. Now, one of the reasons we're able to do that is because we do reject loads that don't meet our qualifications. I know when people come in, they look at the pile, they think we take anything, but the reality of it is we're very fussy in what we take. And we know what we're looking for, and there are certain things we do not want to deal with, and we will reject loads based on that analysis.
And I remember that. I think I saw your little lab set up here a while back, and you do testing for heavy metals and pesticides. Isn't that right?
Well, we test for heavy metals, and we're also testing for asbestos. Mm-hmm. Those are the primary materials of concern that we have to be aware of and deal with and make sure we're not putting into our finished product.
So you take in safe materials, you form reusable materials out of them, but it's a pretty hard surface out here, and I know you have a lot of runoff, and you've got this very interesting detention pond system that I'd like you to tell me a little bit more about in terms of all the different ways the water's filtered before it finally gets out into the environment.
Well, I've always held on to the concept that if at the end of the day we do more harm than good, what's the point? And so one of the areas of concern is stormwater runoff. We sit on 5.2 acres, and as you know, in western Washington, it does tend to rain a lot here, especially in the wintertime. And so we have set up a collection system where all the rainwater runoff from the whole site, the 5.2 acres, goes into a retention pond where we filter it, and then we run it through some flocculants, and then we filter it again. And then after it comes out of the secondary filtering, we push it up through crushed glass sand filters that are continuously self-cleaning. And then the finished product or the clean water from there goes to the stormwater system, the city stormwater system.
Yes, you have a bottle of the water that came out, and I'm looking at it, and it looks, it's perfectly clear, has just maybe a really, really faint yellow tinge to it, and other than that, it looks, or maybe it's just the bottle is yellow.
Yeah, this stuff's looking really good. We're really pleased with how our results are coming. Of course, the real true test is in the testing that we're required to do by the state, and we're waiting for those results to come back. But one of the products that we're working on from our carpet process is a polypropylene oil boom arrangement. We're pretty excited about it because the open matrix of this polypropylene is such that it'll absorb the heavy oils. Most of these oil booms are designed to take on the lighter oils, like the diesel fuels that might get spilled. What we're designing here is going to be more for the heavy engine oils, hydraulic oils, and even crude oils.
Yeah, I was looking at this when we came in, and the typical oil boom looks like it's pretty much stuffed with cotton. This is pretty much what it looks like, kind of cotton batting, I guess. I'm sure it's not cotton because it wouldn't absorb oil.
It is polypropylene, but you're right. It has a look of cotton.
And then your material, which is the stuff from the carpet, is really fibrous, and everybody who's taken out, you know, the cheap nylon carpet knows exactly what this stuff looks like. And it kind of has it's a very much more fibrous material. And it's really pretty exciting what you plan on doing with this, because the fact that it's so fibrous and absorbs heavy oil means that you're using a recycled product to clean up a mess, and then what would you do with it?
That's where it really gets exciting. We're dealing with a company down in Oregon who has developed a process where they can convert plastics into crude oil. Polypropylene converts at a very high rate. So when we're done with this, we can take this polypropylene that we're extracting out of post-consumer carpet, fill these oil booms, use them to absorb these heavy oils, then take that back, put it through the Agilex system, that's the name of the other company, and convert all of it, the plastic or the polypropylene plastic, and the crude oil back into crude oil.
It's just amazing. One thing I wanted to refresh my memory on and tell everybody else about, too, was the uniqueness of this company. You've pretty much had to invent everything as you've gone along, haven't you?
Oh, yes. As you walk through our plant, most of the equipment has been designed and built here at Recovery One. We do have some standard machines, a large shredder from SSI Corporation, a large hammer mill from West Salem Machinery, and then I've got screening equipment that I bought from others, but we have designed and built our gypsum system. We've got special magnetic separators throughout the plant. Our new carpet processing system, there's two machines that are brand new. We've built them. They're our design. Patents have been applied for, and we're hoping to prevail and get two patents on these two machines. So it's interesting when you get in on the front end of a new industry how much innovation has to take place in order for you to work with this material.
So how many other similar industries have sprung up now since you started Recovery One?
There are actually quite a few companies who have decided to get into the C&D or construction and demolition recycling arena. And it's always interesting to me to see at what level they're deciding to get into it. You can turn a blind eye to the potentially hazardous materials that are out there, and you have to be aware of them. I'm continually amazed at how many will handle these materials like there's nothing to be worried about. And believe me, there is.
So if you're curious about this innovative company, you can find more on their website, which is recoveryone, and that's the number one.com. So every week on my podcast, as you know, I like to answer some of your gardening questions based on the theme of the show. A few weeks ago, I mentioned the three P's for getting your garden ready for winter: pruning, planting, and protecting. Last week, I discussed the pruning myth, and today we're going to look at a protection myth. And part of protection means not just your plants, but the soil. And part of protecting your soil means keeping the weeds away while your soil is sitting over the winter. And so I get a lot of questions this time of year about using corn gluten meal as a natural weed killer. So what exactly corn gluten meal is a byproduct, so a leftover, from milling corn. It's a high nitrogen product. By high nitrogen, I mean 10% nitrogen. It's natural, it's a recycled product, and it has documented success in reducing seed germination, which is great. It's been studied extensively at Iowa State, who've identified it as what's called a pre-emergent herbicide. So this means you put it down before weeds start growing. It won't work on existing weeds, but it also doesn't work on existing plants, so it's safe for your existing growing plants. But unfortunately, it doesn't work in all circumstances, and the researchers at Iowa State have been very careful to point out that not only does it not affect the existing weeds, that because it's high nitrogen, it can also act as a fertilizer for those existing weeds. So you have to be very careful in using this product not to make your problem even worse. It's also not selective, and what I mean by this is that it kills everything. So if you're planting it in a vegetable garden where you've just planted the seeds, well, you're pretty much going to kill your vegetable seeds as well. So you have to be careful on applying it where you only have weed seeds present and not any desirable flower or vegetable seeds in the soil. It's also pretty expensive, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. So here's the interesting part from a regional perspective, and this is why I got so intrigued by this product. It works really well in Iowa State. They had good results inside in the lab. They had good results in the greenhouse. They had good results in the field. And this is why they started selling it and became such an interesting and innovative product. But they've studied it also here on the West Coast, and they've had completely different results. It's been studied in California, Oregon, and Washington. And what they've found is when they use this product is that it doesn't seem to work. They've used it in containerized plantings. They've used it in turf. They've used it on field situations, and it just doesn't have the same effect. So it's been very initially confusing because, you know, if it works so well in Iowa when they've tested over and over, why is it not working here? And it turns out because it's a regional thing. And you have to think a little bit now about the difference in climate between the West Coast and the Midwest. Here in the West Coast, we have very wet springs. And this year we had a very wet spring indeed. The only way this product works is if the soil remains dry for a while, because part of the way that it works is to dry out the seedlings. So seedlings start to germinate, they need a lot of water, they're expanding quickly, and this is kind of a desiccant that just goes right on there, sucks the water away from the seedlings, and they dry up. But it doesn't work if the soil stays moist. So here's the first problem. You have to know, you have to predict the weather on whether or not your soil is going to remain dry for about a week. It works pretty well in Iowa because their rainy season is mostly in the summer. So their springs are pretty dry. They can put it down, the soil stays dry, the weed seeds start coming up, and they die. So it works great. Here on the West Coast, it gets wet, it stays wet, it's just plain wet during the spring. So if you put this down in the spring, it's going to be a fertilizer for your weeds and not a weed control mechanism. So that's the big difference. It's not really a myth, it's a regional myth. So it works well in the Midwest, it does not work well in areas that are very wet in the spring or whatever time you tend to be applying your weed control. So it's not only an inconsistent weed control method, it's also a really expensive one. It turns out that you have to buy a lot of this material and apply it not just once a year, but several times a year, and then year after year after year. I just checked on Amazon today, and a 50-pound bag from one company costs $80, and that includes shipping. So if you apply it at the recommended rate of somewhere between 20 and 40 pounds per 1,000 square feet, and do it over and over during only one season, you're going to be spending a lot of money on a very expensive nitrogen fertilizer that the weeds in our part of the country are just going to love. So what I recommend instead are what other researchers found as better ways of controlling weeds. This includes things like what's called sub-irrigation, and so that's with, for us gardeners, that would be soaker hoses rather than overhead sprinklers, or my old standby, mulch, is a much more effective way of keeping the weeds at bay. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. It's my official Washington State University webpage, and it's full of great and free information. You'll also find archived podcasts from our first season there. Second, please join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professor's blog. It's at gardenprofessors.com. And the four of us take turns posting on just about any gardening topic you can imagine. You can even add comments if you feel so inclined. And finally, for those of you who will never give up books until they're pried from your cold, dead hands, I've written three books that might be of interest: The Informed Gardener, The Informed Gardener Blooms Again, and Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. You can find out more information on all three of these books at sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I hope you found this podcast entertaining and useful. I welcome listener comments and questions, and please email me at lindacs@wsu.edu. Be sure to listen next time when our theme will be Gifts That Keep on Giving.